Thank you, Mr. Irvin. I see most people made it back from lunch. Some of you know that I'm a teacher and I have students from time to time who get a little sleepy. In fact, yesterday I had a student that was snoring loud enough that the entire class was noting. And we just looked over and nodded. And it really doesn't pay to do too much to certain personalities. And we let the person, if they can sleep in place, really, that's really a remarkable accomplishment. I did have a problem last semester with several students sleeping, and so I made a deal with the school nurse. And I would give them a pass if they were sleeping. I would give them a pass to the nurse's office, and she would go, and I would send them there, and they were puzzled as to why. I would call them up, give them a pass to nurse's office. I had a little code on there, and she would make sure they drank at least 2 16-ounce bottles of water, hydrate them majorly, the walk to the next building on campus and back, waken them up, and they were gone for 10 or 15 minutes, and they came back, and they were pretty good. If they continued to have a problem, then I invited them to come and stand in the back of the classroom with me, because you have a very difficult time falling asleep while you're standing up. And I've never had a student yet who failed to stay awake while they're standing in the back with me, while they're standing doing their work at a table, you know, and so they aren't embarrassed in front of anybody else, although people can look over their shoulder. And all they can do is see the fellow, you know, amiably standing by the teacher, because I wouldn't have them do anything I wouldn't. So basically, this is your notice. If you're sleeping, you can come up here and stand with me. Not a problem. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but everything will work out fine, I'm sure. This afternoon is the close of the seventh day of unleavened bread, and we are meeting in holy convocation, a formal gathering together as a step in the plan of God that outlines his coming redemption of mankind. We've experienced already Passover and the night to be much remembered as we've kept leaven out of our homes and lives for the past 7 days. And on the first and the seventh day of unleavened bread, the messages have been focused on how to put sin out of our lives just as we put leaven out of our diets and homes for a week. Having said that, Mr. Johnson gave a sermon recently on slavery, so I set that one aside. I guess I won't give that one this afternoon. And thankfully, the sermonette pretty well took care of that. And then the one on commitment, I guess that one I had to set aside. And then there was the one about coming out of Egypt and the challenges there. So I'm working on a rewrite as we speak. Now, having mentioned, and this is the first time I've spoken, I must say, in the afternoon on a holy day. I don't recall having that experience before. And I understand now what the situation is you be prepared for the rewrite on the fly. Well, some of you know that I teach high school social studies, and one of those is an economics class. And much to the students' surprise, they find out that the definition of economics is the study of people's decisions in a world of limited resources. Economics is really a study in behavioral psychology, except that economists have a way of using numbers with dollar signs and graphs and charts and such to explain what they mean. Well, as you can imagine, how and why we make decisions as individuals and as a society are not limited to the economics world. And so today's message is not a class in economics, but it's a message about the study of decision making and how the little decisions we make today can have consequential results tomorrow. So the title of this message is The Law of Unintended Consequences. But having mentioned the law of unintended consequences and the subject of economics, one that's dear to my heart, and I have a degree in it, so you can know that I have I've been steeped in it for a while. The law of unintended consequences is often cited. According to the Library of Economics Liberty, there is such an encyclopedia. It's online. And it says this law is often cited but rarely defined, or the actions of people, and especially of government, have always had effects that are unanticipated or unintended. Economists and other social scientists have heeded its power for centuries. For just as long, politicians and popular opinion have largely ignored it, meaning ignored the law of unintended consequences. The concept of unintended consequences is one of the building blocks of economics. Perhaps some of you read in school about Adam Smith writing The Wealth of Nations, wrote it in 1776 about the free enterprise system. And he used the term the invisible hand that is an example of a positive unintended consequence. Smith maintained that each individual seeking his own gain is led by an invisible hand to promote an end which has no part of his intention, and that end being the public interest. It's not from the benevolence of the butcher or the baker that we expect our dinners, Smith wrote, but with regard to their own self-interests. However, Adam Smith was not alone. There was an English philosopher about 80 years earlier, named John Locke. And John Locke was a forerunner of what we call modern economists, urged the defeat of a parliamentary bill in England that was designed to cut the maximum permissible rate of interest from 6% to 4%. Sounds good on the surface, right? Nobody should be have to pay more than that. But John Locke argued that instead of benefiting borrowers as intended, it would hurt them. People would find ways to circumvent the law, with the cost of circumvention borne by the borrowers. To the extent then that the law was obeyed, Locke concluded the chief results would be less available credit, a redistribution of income away from the investors, widows and orphans, and those who have estates kept in their name. So it would lower the money available to people who were relying on interest income. And so you have a third philosopher, a French economic journalist named Frédéric Bastiat, who was often distinguished in his writing in the two things, the seen and the unseen. And we often make decisions about the seen because that seems to us to be obvious, but the unseen is really what rules the day. The unseen is the less obvious, and then the unintended consequences. He wrote a famous essay, What is Seen and What is Not Seen. And in this he wrote, there's only one difference between a bad economist and a good one. The bad economist confines himself to the visible effect, and a good economist takes into account both the effect that can be seen and those effects that must be foreseen. Perhaps you can see where we're going with this. In the world of economics, is not the only place that people make choices. Because we're dealing with decisions and consequences from those decisions. When we think of the word consequence, it's probably fair to say we usually think of bad consequences. We think about bad things that can happen, or if we do something, or perhaps if there's something that we should have done and we did not. However, the word consequences is really neutral because consequences can be either good or bad. Recently, we looked at Hosea 10, in verse 12, in Hosea 10, verse 12, and we read this with regarding the subject of righteousness. Sow for yourselves righteousness, reap in mercy, break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord, till he comes and rains righteousness on you. So sowing righteousness allows you to enjoy directly the benefits of having righteousness rain down upon you. Well, enjoying the reign of righteousness that the eternal God gives us is a consequence, a good consequence, or a good result. And sometimes the little things we do today have an unintended effect. And that effect can multiply such that tomorrow might be much bigger than what we had anticipated when we did some of that little thing or we neglected to do something. So consequences or results can be a wonderful thing or a terrible thing. It really depends on our decisions, whether it's seen or unseen. And sometimes a totally unexpected result occurs. to explore this a little further, in the social sciences, unintended consequences, sometimes unintended consequences, or meaning unforeseen consequences, are outcomes not intended by your purposeful action or decisions. The term was popularized by an American sociologist, Robert Merton. Unintended consequences are grouped into three parts. A positive expected benefit, usually referred to as luck or a windfall. And then there's a negative unexpected consequence, a detriment that occurs in addition to the desired effect of the policy. and an example of that would be, well, here's an irrigation scheme and it can provide lots of water for irrigation. However, the unintended consequence, waterborne diseases have a devastating health effect, and you have more mosquitoes and all the diseases they carry. And then the third unintended consequence can be a perverse effect, contrary to what was intended, when the intended solution actually makes the problem worse. And of course, we tend to focus on that. But really, the Bible does provide a number of examples of people who experienced unintended consequences. But before we can examine the effect of unintended consequences, we must understand the difference between natural or logical consequences and then legal consequences or results. There's a writer, a magazine, an e-zine writer, Rafael Marquez, who writes about natural consequences. He says, natural consequences are inevitable. They follow every task or activity that gets done or not. They're not always a bad thing, but most people associate bad things with the word. Everything you do and everything you don't do has a consequence that results. Essentially, think of the word consequence as the word result. The result can be positive attribute depending on your point of view. There's no way to avoid consequences. Deal with it, learn it, love it, live it. Here's an example. And we can understand this because we live these things. If you fail to get up and go to work, you'll lose your job. If you lose your job, you won't be able to buy food or money to pay the rent. But if you get up and work smart, eventually you'll make more money, eat better, and be able to buy a house, or and so forth. So actions determine the consequences, and consequences, by definition, are not something to be avoided. Well, natural or logical consequences are the result when you do nothing at all to change your own behavior. Or if you're a parent, it's you do nothing at all to change your child's behavior. Well, I mentioned the parents observing their child's behavior because we're God's children. And he's observing our behavior. And understanding then the difference between natural consequences and legal consequences gives us insight into how God allows us to stumble along and then how God provides for our ultimate salvation. An excerpt from an elementary school teacher's writing about natural consequences helps provide this insight. And a fellow by the name of Teacher Tom's blog about writing about the law of natural consequences in July of 2009. He writes about the story about a preschool teacher who didn't let her daughter out of her sight. She obsessively followed her daughter Sophie everywhere, but was especially attentive on the playground. The teacher tried to persuade the mother to give Sophie more space, but she wouldn't hear it. When it came time for kindergarten, the mother reluctantly let her daughter go on that first day. A couple hours later, the school nurse called. Sophie had fallen from the climbing structure and needed a ride to the doctor. When the parent later reported this to the teacher, she said, to the mother, she said, "My daughter broke her arm because I wasn't there." The teacher answered, "Your daughter broke your arm because you were always there." You see, most things are learned best through real experiences, and in most cases, no amount of safe talk about being careful is going to help. Sophie had come to rely on her mother to be there to help her climb and catch her when she fell from the time she started climbing. She hadn't experienced falling on the small, relatively safe preschooler climber, and so she hadn't developed the requisite caution she would need for the larger elementary school apparatus. Of course, Sophie may still have broken her arm on the first day of kindergarten, but the teacher's point is well taken. Natural consequences are life's greatest teacher. One of the best ways, quote, one of the best ways to learn about asphalt is to fall on it, is one of the mantras then at this particular school. Our playground surface is made of hard stuff, and no amount of warning children to be careful has ever worked as well as a scraped knee or two or three or four to teach children they might want to save their wilder play for the gym or on the wood chips. We won't always be there to catch our children when they fall. But the law of natural consequences isn't for only learning about asphalt. The teacher says she never makes children, for example, to put their coats on to go outside, even when it's bitterly cold or pouring rain. If it's too cold or wet, even the two-year-olds will on their own ask for a coat and eventually learn to anticipate the need in the future. The natural consequence of eating Play-Doh is a yucky taste. The natural consequence of putting gum in your hair is a sticky mess. The natural consequence of not making it to the toilet in time, soggy undies. The natural consequence of not eating the snack at snack time is hunger. And sometimes the consequence of products being a member of a community or products of being a member of a community, while they may not depend on physics or biology, they're nonetheless natural consequences. The natural consequence for a child of not raising her hand during circle time is you don't get a chance to speak. The natural consequence of knocking over someone else's building blocks is you have to help rebuild it. The natural consequence of breaking a rule is that someone else will point to the list of rules and say, "You're breaking a rule." The natural consequence of playing at preschool is that you're expected then to help clean up. Well, God has established natural laws in the universe and has allowed mankind the past 6,000 years to make mistakes. And while we can disagree with the law of gravity, we're still going to get hurt if we fall down. We can disagree with the laws of inertia, momentum, centrifugal force, or laws relating to chemical reactions, but the natural effects of breaking those laws will still occur. Now, of course, in natural consequences, if parents are using them in discipline, if you go to the internet and type in EHOW and how to use natural consequences in discipline, there's 3 points. How allow the consequences to happen. Natural consequences are what naturally follow from an action, so parents must prepare themselves to watch their children deal with the results of their action on their own. If the child refuses to do her homework, allow her to go to school without having it completed. That way, she'll learn she must take responsibility. If she doesn't fulfill her obligations, that she will learn that rather than having you cover for her. Number 2, don't rescue the child when he gets upset. If your child is always counting on you for a rescue, he will learn his actions about not about his actions, but about reactions in others. Allowing the child to truly experience consequence, you can teach self-discipline. Thirdly, use the consequence that occur to teach the child. Forcing the child to deal with the consequences of his action and telling him the reason for these consequences increases the likelihood of him learning from his mistakes, which can improve his decision-making in the future and prevent him, hopefully, from making the same mistakes as he matures. I was a little over 40 years old, and I just was was back on the farm. I was in my early to mid-40s, and I just made some screw-up. I just messed up, and my dad turned, and he says, "You know, I don't mind if you make if you make a mistake once in a while, I just want you to make different ones." Now, I hadn't heard that one before, and I said, "You know, Dad, it would have helped out maybe 40 years ago. Maybe I could have heard that one." I caught the hint, I guess. Apparently, I had done that before. If you go online, there's the state of New Mexico has a chart, natural and logical consequences. And you look down the chart for child rearing, which my father apparently knew he still needed to do. Child forgets to return library book. Consequence, child cannot check out any more library books. Lesson learned, child learns to be more responsible and remembering the next time. And it goes down the line. Interesting, natural and logical consequence, something that flows forth. And then there's the legal effect of breaking the law. Now, this is different than the natural consequence or the natural effect of breaking a law. For example, you might violate a natural law by driving too fast around a curve. The natural effect is you might lose control of the car, drive off the road, wreck your car, and possibly injuring yourself or passengers. The legal effect is when the police come along, issue you a citation for failure to maintain control of the vehicle. There might be a stiff fine. You could lose your driving privileges. The legal effect then is an additional burden that's placed upon the driver to compel the driver to be extra cautious and safe. Legal consequences are actions by a second or third party designed to prevent or correct misbehavior. I want to take a look now at a biblical example of an unfortunate case that's preserved for our benefit. It's in Genesis 4. I want to take a look at the example of Cain and Abel in Genesis 4, and starting in verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and conceived and bore Cain and said, "I've acquired a man from the Lord." And then to her she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering to the of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. Verse 6, so the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Now, verse 8, now Cain talked with his brother Abel, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Now, the Eternal talked to Cain and said that you should rule over it, and yet Cain let this one overcome him. Verse 9, and the Eternal said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? Cain said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And verse 10, and he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. You see, God knew what was going on. And Cain didn't do very well in the test, either to learn to do well and to get rid of the sin that was at his door. And he tried to cover it up by saying, well, what am I, my brother's keeper? But God knew what was going on the whole time. And verse 12, when you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth. Verse 13, now it's interesting here. And Cain said to the Eternal, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Ooh, I don't think he anticipated this. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on earth. And it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me. Oh, Cain now realized he had been found out. He was being thrust out of human company, away from the others, and he knew that he was now a target because that he had killed someone. He was apparently aware that he was a target for vengeance. And verse 15, and the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod in the east of Eden. Well, Cain was a murderer. His punishment was banishment. And God let Cain live and set Cain apart as an example to others. God intervened with a legal consequence when Cain deserved death. And ultimately he did die of this physical life. But God preserved his life as an example and intervened. If we turn to 1 John 3, in 1 John 3, we read a little bit more in verses 11 through 13. In 1 John 3, 11, for this is the message you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. Verse 13, do not marvel, my brother, and if the world hates you, we know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. At first, Cain tried to deflect the question about his brother Abel, am I my brother's keeper? But Cain's sin was egregious, and the natural consequence was banishment or death by vengeance from anyone who should find Cain. So God then placed a mark on Cain, that Cain would live out his life with the knowledge of what he had done. The legal consequences of the mark on Cain was to protect Cain from the natural consequence, which would have been death by vengeance. Cain's example is also brought forth when the Bible discusses the danger of false ministers in Jude 1. There's only one chapter in Jude. In Jude 1, verse 11. And here's the discussion in the book of Jude about false ministers. Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain. Skipping to verse 12, these are spots in your love feasts, while they feast with you without fear, meaning the false ministers, serving only themselves. They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, late autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots. God shows that the consequence of following the way of Cain is the way of death, and the way of Cain is often disguised by those false ministers who purport to teach the truth, Yet they, the false ministers, are really self-serving. They're pictured as clouds without water and dead trees with no fruit. Or, as they say in Texas, they're all hat and no cattle. The natural consequence of Cain killing Abel was for Cain to be subject then to retribution, that he might get killed, but the legal consequence was to keep him alive, as an example. It's safe to say that Cain did not foresee the unintended consequence of murdering his brother Abel. Apparently, it did not occur to Cain that he could be banished for life from the presence of others. And then there's another case that we read. It's in Genesis 13. In Genesis 13, we recently heard about the story of Lot. And that's recorded for our benefit in Genesis 13. In verse 1, "And then Abram went up from Egypt, and he and his wife with all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and gold, and he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord." Verse 5, "Lot also, who went with Cain, or went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and Perizzites then dwelt in the land." Verse 8, "So Abraham said to Lot, 'Please let there be no strife between you and me, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we're brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the gift, or take the left, I will go to the right. Or if you go to the right, I will go to the left.' Verse 10, 'And Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, and it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. It was watered like the garden of the Lord for the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. And then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan. And Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. And Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom." Lot, you see, was a wealthy man. He made what he thought was a good choice, to move his herds and flocks to a grassy plain where his wealth would continue to increase. And yet just a few years later, Lot lost almost everything, including his wife. He escaped Sodom with the clothes on his back. It does not appear that Lot anticipated the consequences of pitching his tent near Sodom. You see, Lot was influenced by too much sin that gradually surrounded him and ultimately cost him everything. Well, the story of Lot demonstrates what we call the law of unintended consequences, which by definition can be a perverse and unexpected effect resulting from a decision. There's another example of an unintended consequence in 2 Samuel in chapter 6. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, it's the story of the death of Uzzah. In 2 Samuel 6, and verse 1, "And David," now this is many years down the road after the children of Israel were out of Egypt. Generations later, David was the king over Israel. "And again, David gathered all of the choice men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, whose name is called by the name the Lord of hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. So they set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab. Okay. I'm working on that one. I had it all down for days now. Okay. Which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drove the new cart, and they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, accompanying the ark of God. And Ahio went before the ark," meaning he walked before it. "Then David and all the house of Israel played music before the Lord of all kinds of instruments, of fir wood, on harps, on stringed instruments, on tambourines, on sistrums, and on cymbals." It sounds like a marching band or a traveling orchestra. This was a great joy that they would be able to bring the Ark of the Covenant more central to the kingdom instead of being off in a separate place. Verse 6, "And when they came to Nashon's threshing floor, Uzzah," now this is the son of Abinadab, "put his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and the Lord and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. And David became angry because the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. Verse 9, David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" So David would not move the ark of the Lord with him to the city of David. But David took it aside into the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. Well, that's quite a story. And it was a serious matter because Uzzah died. But why? Uzzah was trying to seemingly do a good thing. He was trying to steady the Ark of the Covenant so it would not fall. I mean, what could be so wrong about that? First, we should understand a bit about the Ark of the Covenant. I want to spend a little bit of time here because the Ark is a chest of wood that was covered in gold. The Ark contained the stone tablets that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai. And the Ark also contained Moses' writings, the books of the law that we call the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. We know this because in Deuteronomy 31, in verse 26, in the New King James Version, in verse 26, "Take this book of the law and put it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there as a witness against you." Well, the Ark also had contained a few other items of note. The writer of the book of Hebrews describes how the tabernacle was furnished. And in particular, the writer described what was in the Holy of Holies, the central part of the tabernacle. Now, let me put an inset here that I didn't include in my notes. But when the children of Israel were wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years, they maintained a tabernacle, a movable temple, as it were, where it had had a specific construction and a specific kinds of, you might say, furnishings or interior decoration. It had to be in a certain way. God outlined how that should be, what it should look like, what it should be like. And so you had an outer court and an inner court, and basically in the future there was a temple that was designed similarly to hold the Ark of the Covenant. In Hebrews 9, starting in verse 1, "Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service in the earthly sanctuary, for a tabernacle was prepared, the first part, which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And behind it, the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory and overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail." So it tells us here what was in this box, this wooden box that's covered with gold. And included in that was something called, and of course we're familiar with the Ten Commandments, those stone tablets. And so I won't go there for the moment, but Aaron's rod. Well, Aaron's rod, you see, Moses had a rod, and Aaron had a rod. This was their staff that was both a symbol of authority, and I presume it was also somewhat helpful that when you were walking, you maintained a staff or a rod as a matter of self-protection in the event that you should come across if we were in this area, it would be a wild dog or a coyote or anything else that might be a problem for you. And so it was universally and culturally expected that when people went from one place to another, that they would carry a staff or a rod. Well, Aaron was Moses' elder brother, who was designated as the head of the Levitical priesthood. And there are two occasions in which Aaron's rod was involved in miraculous events. In Exodus 7, verse 8. In Exodus 7, starting in verse 8. This is the first event about Aaron's rod. "When the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, When Pharaoh speaks to you, show a miracle for yourselves. Then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your rod and cast it before Pharaoh and let it become a serpent.'" Now, I don't know about you folks. I have never seen a rod become a serpent. Now, we were a few weeks ago down in McKinney, Texas for the teen dance and dinner. And at the Heard Natural Museum, I found this really handy, dandy walking stick, as it were, a rod. And I envisioned it would be like Moses or Aaron's, only that one was designed to be Gandalf's stick in the Lord of the Rings. And since they call me Gandalf at school because I'm tall and have a graying beard, and apparently a facial resemblance, I thought it would be nice to have the Gandalf stick. So I picked it up, and I could not imagine casting it down and it turning into a serpent. And so in verse 10, so Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did so as the Lord commanded, and Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. Verse 11, but Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, so the magicians of Egypt, they also did in the manner with their enchantments. For every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. Now, folks, that has got to be a bad day. When you see somebody throwing down, and you know they're not on God's side, and they throw down a rod and they become serpents. This has to be unsettling in the least. I would want no part of a place like that. But then we read on in this verse. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. Who is more powerful? The God of Aaron and Moses, or the gods of the pharaohs and the sorcerers? In another situation, there was a question as to who had the authority regarding the priesthood. When Moses and the children of Israel were wandering for 40 years in the wilderness following their escape from Egypt, the people were saying that if Aaron didn't have the authority, and Moses was then instructed on how to resolve the matter. We read that in number 17. And this is the event that describes that second miracle with regard to Aaron's rod. In chapter 17, verse 1 of Numbers, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and get them from them a rod from each father's house, all their leaders according to their father's houses, 12 rods. In other words, one rod for each of the children, each of the sons of Jacob from whom they have descended. And write each man's name on his rod, and you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi. For there shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. Then you shall place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Thus I will rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel, which they make against you. Now, I'm not Mr. Irvin. I can't make things blossom so well. But I have seen blossoms. And I have a few small dwarf fruit trees, and they do blossom. I have never seen a rod blossom, okay? Particularly not one that's like a staff or a stick. So moving on to verse 6. Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and each of their leaders gave him a rod apiece. For each leader, according to their father's houses, 12 rods, and the rod of Aaron was among their rods. And Moses placed the rods before the Lord in the tabernacle of witness. Verse 8, now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds, had produced blossoms and yielded ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. And the Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put their complaints away from me, lest they die. Thus did Moses, just as the Lord had commanded him, so did he. Well, that rod, Aaron's rod, was placed in the Ark of the Covenant. I don't know if it still had the ripe almonds on it, but the rod was placed in the Ark. So we had the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. We had Aaron's rod. And then there was the golden pot that held the manna in the ark, and referred to in Hebrews 9, represents that miraculous bread that was delivered to God by God to the Israelites to sustain them for 40 years in the wilderness. And because the Ark of the Covenant was in the holiest of holies in the tabernacle, it had special significance and commanded respect. The Ark of the Covenant was the repository of those certain items that were memorials of God's law and miracles. So we know that they had the tablets, the manna pot, the Aaron's budded rod, and then the first 5 books of the Bible, the Moses' writings. The ark was only to be carried by certain people. These were the sons of Kohath. We'll learn that in Numbers 4:15. And even they were not to touch it because the ark was considered holy. in Numbers 4:15, when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all of the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is set to go, this is when they're moving the tabernacle around in the wilderness following the children of Israel, then the sons of Kohath shall carry them, but they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die. So as the children of Israel moved about the wilderness, there was a need to move the tabernacle, and that included the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark was designated or designed to be carried in a certain way by the Levites. We learn that way in Exodus 25. In Exodus 25, in verses 13 through 15, tells us how the ark was designed, how it was to be carried. Exodus 25, 13, and you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put the poles into the rings on the side of the ark that the ark may be carried by them. The poles shall be in the rings of the ark. They shall not be taken from it. Actually, it's very similar as to what you would see like a coffin with the handles on the side. It would be rings along the side. They would stick poles, a wooden pole that was coated in gold. They would put it through the ark. There would be priests on each side, and they would hold it on their shoulders. And then multiple priests would be carrying this ark by hand and foot. Well, Joshua 3 describes how the Ark of the Covenant was to be deeply respected and hand-carried, borne by the priest, as the children of Israel then crossed the Jordan River and into the Promised Land. And this occurred about the time of the Passover and just the beginning, just before the days of unleavened bread. But so this was right on the cusp of that time. And the priests then, and this is in Joshua 3, we will read, the priests that carrying the ark stood in the river Jordan, and the water stopped to allow the Israelites to cross the Jordan River into the land of Canaan, the promised land. This crossing is analogized to 40 years earlier when the Israelites crossed the parted Red Sea as they left Egypt, and as we heard in the sermonette this morning. So you have this situation where the priests, as it spells it out in Joshua 3, and I'm not going to go over the whole chapter, but they were properly carrying the ark. And they were putting it on their shoulders, the priests. In fact, they were told to stand in the middle of the river. You'll be in the water, and then the water will be stopped up, and that will hold off. And so, what, 1 to 2 million people of the Israelites will cross into the land of Canaan. So now we're looking ahead many, many years. It was after the conquest of Canaan, and now we're looking at David as a king over Israel. It's past the time of the judges, past the time of King Saul. And David is king. So we're left to ask the question, why did Uzzah die when he was clearly trying to do the right thing by preventing the Ark of the Covenant from tipping over? Well, there are several reasons that we should note. First, King David thought to do a good thing by having the Ark brought to a central location. He sent his men. See, before that, it was somewhat ignored by King Saul. It wasn't as important to King Saul. David sent his men to build a new cart to transport the Ark. After all, not just any cart will do. It had to be a new one. So he had his carpenters build a new cart. However, as we read in Exodus 24 and verse 14, the ark was designed to be carried in a special way, using poles carried on the shoulders of the priests, and that the children of Kohath, or the descendants of Kohath. The ark was not to be transported on a cart, even if it was new or especially built for that purpose. So Uzzah's method of moving the Ark of the Covenant was a mistake. He was not moving the ark in a manner prescribed by God. He did not bear the ark personally with several other priests by placing the carrying poles through the rings of the ark that was designed as it was designed to be carried. Instead, Uzzah placed the ark on an ox cart. Presumably, this was the typical two-wheeled ox cart that of that day that was subject to tipping, because a four-wheeled wagon would be not called a cart in the same way. A different device. Well, Moses had earlier directed that carts be used for transport. We read about this in Numbers 7, because they're transporting items for the tabernacle from place to place. However, Moses specifically said in Numbers 7:9, he did not allocate carts to the sons of Kohath, because they were to carry the holy things on their shoulders. And as we read in Exodus 25, the ark was designed then with those rings on the side that the poles could be placed through. So in number 7:9, but to the sons of Kohath he gave none, meaning he didn't give them carts, because theirs was the service of the holy things which they carried on their shoulders. An ox cart was not used, not to be used to transport the ark. But unfortunately for Uzzah, the ox pulling the cart stumbled, and the ark was nearly dumped over. Even though we mean well, do we do things the way God expects of us? Are we mindful of the path that God has set before us, or do we offer sacrifices in the manner of Cain, with Cain's "I'll do it my way" approach? Is there a little bit of Cain in each of us? The second reason that Uzzah had a problem is we read in 2 Samuel 6:3 that the ark had resided in the home of Abinadab for some time. There's an old saying that familiarity breeds contempt. And Uzzah was the son of Abinadab. While Uzzah may have been generally respectful of the ark, he became too casual with it, even touching it, when he had to have known it was forbidden to touch the ark. Yet Uzzah touched the ark and then bore the consequences of that act. How familiar have we become with the things of God? Has our familiarity with God's truth caused us to be casual about the things that God considers holy? Is there a bit of Uzzah in each one of us? The third thing about Uzzah's situation is that Uzzah felt the need to save the ark from tipping. But we must ask the question, does God really need our help? In Numbers 20, verse 7 through 12, there's an example about Moses, and he was exasperated. The children of Israel needed water, and he felt the need to help God along a little bit by striking the rock that God had told him to strike, but not in God's name. He struck the rock to obtain water for the Israelites, and by taking the action upon himself, Moses lost the opportunity to enter the promised land. Do we also help God by deciding to take shortcuts and do things our own way? In each of these cases, whether it's Cain or Lot or Uzzah or Moses, we see the results of unintended consequences. Cain didn't anticipate being banished. Lot lost everything. Uzzah died, and Moses did not enter the promised land, all because they did not foresee the consequences of their actions. Just as parents allow their children to learn from their mistakes, so had God provided mankind with instruction and opportunity for 6,000 years to learn from that instruction. God provides the physical laws of the universe whereby we can predictably rely upon those physical laws in our daily lives. And if those physical laws are violated, we suffer the natural consequences of that violation. If we fall down, we skin our knees. If we don't eat enough, we get hungry. If we eat too much, we get sluggish. And hopefully we learn our physical limits. Well, God provides the spiritual laws. And if we break those laws, we also suffer natural consequences of those violations. However, we can be thankful we have a God who can pardon our iniquities, who can heal our diseases, both physical and spiritual, and who can grant us life when we deserve death. Let's turn to Isaiah 55. In Isaiah 55. I was going to read one or two verses, but Isaiah 55 is really the whole thought is carried through Isaiah 55. In verse 1, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come, buy, and eat. Yes, come, buy wine and milk, without money, without price. Why do you spend money for what is not bread? And your wages for what does not satisfy. Listen to me and eat what is good. Let your soul delight itself in abundance. Is this what we do? Is this where our priorities are? We're being told here that the lesser things in life are some of those physical things that we often see as our biggest challenges. And yet, what's the most valuable thing? What was the most valuable thing to Cain that he overlooked? The most valuable thing to Lot that he overlooked, the most valuable thing to Uzzah that he overlooked. And indeed, as great as Moses was and the great servant that he was, he even had a time when he overlooked the most important thing. In verse 3, incline your ear and come to me, hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, the sure mercies of David. Indeed, I have given him as a witness to the people, a leader and a commander for the people. Surely you shall call a nation you do not know, and nations who do not know who do not know you shall run to you because of the Lord your God and the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor my ways your ways, nor your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing which I sent, for which I sent it. For you shall go out with joy and be led out with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth into singing before you, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree. And it shall be to the Lord for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. What a great opportunity we have to absorb, to understand the will and the ways of God. We can avoid the law of unintended consequences by carefully respecting the laws of God. We can enjoy then the benefits of God's ways that come through the fruit of righteousness. And as we close out this Feast of Unleavened Bread, let's carry the lessons of Cain, Lot, Uzzah, and Moses to heart. To avoid doing religion in our own way, to be careful not to become careless with the truths of God, and not to suppose that we of our own accord can help God along.